services earlier this month when Iraq's military retook the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. The ceasefire comes after more than 2 weeks of largely low-level clashes and warnings from the coalition that the dispute was distracting from the IS fight. This is VOA News. Kenya's Election Commission said that 6.5 million people, or about a third of registered voters, went to the polls in the rerun presidential election on Thursday, despite the opposition's call for a boycott. Officials say the voting is expected to resume on Saturday in some locations because several polling stations were unable to open due to security concerns, though opposition leaders are still warning their supporters to stay away. The voting was marred by protests, and at least two people were shot dead during clashes between police and protesters. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, along with four senators, have been disqualified from Parliament because they held dual citizenship at the time of the last election. Malcolm Turnbull is the Australian Prime Minister.
The decision of the court today is clearly not the outcome we were hoping for, but the business of government goes on.
Australia's constitution bans subjects of foreign powers from sitting in Parliament. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has no role to play in the future of his country, and he must go. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
He says the United States wants to see Syria emerge from this war as a whole and unified country, a country in which President Bashar al-Assad has no role to play.
I've said this many times as well, that we do not believe there is a future for the Assad regime, the Assad family. I think I've said it on a number of occasions. The reign of the Assad family is coming to an end, and the only issue is how should that be brought about? And we believe it can be brought about and will be brought about.
Tillerson says he supports the so-called Geneva process, which seeks a peaceful, negotiated end to the Syrian war. He notes the process sets out specific procedures for holding elections, but has no prerequisite that Assad goes before the process starts. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis visited South Korea Friday, meeting with top defense officials and American military commanders. He repeated the Trump administration's push for a diplomatic solution to the North Korean problem.
As the U.S. Secretary of State Tillerson has made clear, our goal is not war, but rather the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Mattis also has said that the U.S. is prepared to take military action if the North does not halt its development of missiles. And British Security Minister Ben Wallace said Friday that Britain believes quite strongly North Korea was responsible for the WannaCry cyber attack earlier this year. In Washington, I'm Doug Bernard.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The UN Refugee Agency says a new potential refugee crisis may be developing as hundreds of Togolese refugees flee political instability and escalating violence.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Full details coming up also. Kenya's Electoral Commission has called for patience and calm as its ally tallies the results of yesterday's rerun presidential election. And the city of Ambo in Ethiopia's Oromoya region is quiet a day after a clash between protesters and security forces left 11 people dead. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Kenya's Electoral Commission has called for patience and calm as it tallies the results of yesterday's rerun election. Presidential election. However, some already fear that the low turnout, just 35% compared to nearly 80% in the previous poll in August, may undercut the credibility of the results. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The chief of Kenya's Electoral Commission says 6.5 million voters, about one-third of all registered voters, cast ballots in the election Thursday. Opposition leader Raila Odinga told his supporters to boycott the vote, and some polling stations looked like ghost towns. Others had lines, but significantly shorter than the original August election. Some were closed entirely due to security concerns. Morithi Mutiga is the International Crisis Group's Kenya analyst.
If this turns out to be the final act in what has been a very dramatic election, it will be a very unsatisfactory conclusion for all sides. Certainly for the president, he will move forward with what seems like a very shaky mandate without a clear mandate from the people. That's a very, very low turnout. It's the lowest turnout in Kenya's multi-party history. We've had six elections since 1992, and the lowest was just about 57%. In general, Kenyan election turnout levels are always above 65%.
The Electoral Commission said voting would take place Saturday in four areas of western Kenya where polling was halted due to violent clashes between protesters and security forces. But late on Friday, the commission said electoral staff would be at risk and postpone the voting to an undetermined future date. As of mid-afternoon Friday, the IEBC reported that it had received the large majority of official polling station forms and official constituency forms back from the field, but had yet to announce any vote count. President Uhuru Kenyatta is making his second attempt at re-election. The Supreme Court nullified his victory in the August 8th poll, ruling that the Electoral Commission had not followed electoral law into the Constitution. Odinga called for several members of the commission to step down and for the polls to be postponed beyond a 60-day deadline announced by the court. The opposition has not said whether it plans to file a legal challenge against the results of Thursday's election. Odinga told supporters he would give further instructions on Monday. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Political and religious leaders in western Kenya warn that plans to reattempt polling in four counties will further inflame tensions. The Electoral Commission had to postpone voting in those areas yesterday due to security concerns and an opposition boycott. Late today, the Electoral Commission postponed the voting again, citing threats to electoral staff. No new date has been announced. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Kisumu.
Western Kenya is a stronghold of opposition leader Raila Odinga. Residents say they plan to respect Odinga's call to boycott the polls. Resident Joshua Ochieng says, "I'm not going to vote, and I will make sure no one goes to vote, because every time we vote, our victory is stolen. This should be the last time our victory is stolen." Violent unrest prevented polling stations from opening in the city of Kisumu Thursday. Youths blocked roads and clashed with security forces. Hospital officials tell VOA three people were killed by gunshot wounds and more than 50 were injured. There were more protests in some parts of western Kenya Friday. Local media report that one person was shot dead in Bungoma County. Church leaders in Kisumu gave a press conference Friday, saying they feared more bloodshed if election officials tried to proceed with polling. Bishop David Kodaya of the Anglican Church of Kenya Bondo Diocese.
We want to say categorically as church leaders, we don't condone violence and will never condone it in any other way. But every individual, every single human being has a right to self-defense. And a time may come when our people will have to defend themselves in whichever way possible.
Kisumu County Governor Anyang Nyong'o said people cannot be forced to take part in the election.
The assumption is really made that if these people have said that they're not going to vote, then the next step that the government should take is bring force here to force them to vote or to force them not to prevent others not to vote. Now, that's a tall order. I'd rather you persuade them not to do that than create maximum force to force them. You just alienate people further.
Kisumu was mostly quiet Friday, with many streets clear to traffic and some shops open for business. But late in the day, VOA saw youth burning tires and blocking some roads in the city. They told VOA they were trying to block the delivery of ballot papers. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Kisumu, Kenya.
The UN Refugee Agency says a new potential refugee crisis may be developing as hundreds of Togolese refugees flee political instability and escalating violence. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says more than 500 Togolese have recently arrived in Ghana seeking asylum. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baloche says they are fleeing political unrest in their country.
Togolese seeking safety, including women and children, told UNHCR staff earlier this month that they had fled on foot walking from their homes in Togo's Mengo region, bordering Ghana. They said they were fleeing human rights abuses after the recent political protests.
At least 10 people have been killed in anti-government protests in Togo since August. Opponents are calling on President Faure Gnassingbé to step down and for a return to the 1992 constitution, which imposes term limits. The president took power in 2005 and can continue to run until 2030 under current law. The opposition considers that unacceptable and is demanding electoral reform. Balash tells VOA the UNHCR hopes the situation is resolved soon and that the agency does not end up having to deal with another refugee crisis in Africa.
Togo's neighboring countries are quite worried that if the situation is not resolved soon, maybe more people would flee. That's why they have approached the UN Refugee Agency to prepare themselves for any further refugee arrivals.
Balar says nearly 30 asylum seekers reportedly have arrived recently in northern Benin. He says it is not clear whether that is related to the current unstable situation in Togo. He says so far there are no reports of asylum seekers arriving in Burkina Faso. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
14 past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The city of Ambo in Ethiopia's Oromoya region is quiet a day after a clash between protesters and security forces left 11 people dead. The town's head of communications, Gadisa Dasaleng, told VOA's Horn of Africa service that 15 people also were injured in protests yesterday. He said most of the victims were university students, although one 13-year-old child was killed. The latest protest was triggered by shortages of sugar. Dasaleng said federal and special elite Agassi forces who deployed to the area early yesterday were responsible for the deaths. VOA's Horn of Africa service contacted the Ethiopian government for comment, but so far has not received a reply. Last year, government development plans, which opponents said amounted to a land grab, sparked months of protests in Oromoya. Nearly 700 people were killed in one bout of unrest last year. The UN-sponsored dialogue to restart the negotiations for a political solution in Libya faces new challenges. The House of Representatives, which is aligned with the commander of the Libyan National Army, General Khalifa Haftar, suspended participation in the dialogue. The House members want a written position from the rival High Council of State before continuing talks. And some militias that General Haftar supports have attacked neighborhoods in the suburbs of Tripoli. Isander El Amrani is the North Africa Project Director of the International Crisis Group. He told VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi that the talks are not yet completely derailed.
Right now, that seems more like a temporary setback. I believe the UN negotiating team is trying to address some of these issues, and indeed the House of Representatives delegation has offered a solution, which is that the State Council make its position clear. So it would derail it only if they now decide not to come back, but that's not clear at the moment.
But local media close to General Haftar say the general has a plan for conquering Tripoli without firing a single shot. Would that mean he is still resorting to force himself from a position of absolute power?
Well, I think the plan that is being alluded to is that General Haftar would convince various militias in the West to switch sides, and so he would be able to take control of the capital without firing a single shot. Some worry that this may be possible. General Haftar has been able to secure the support of local groups before in other parts of the country, in the south and in the Gulf of Sirte area, for instance, in the last year. However, Tripoli is a bit different in that it has strong militias that are well-armed, that are backed by the UN-recognized government, including some that would be extremely unlikely to cut a deal with General Haftar against that government, simply because they are on complete ideological opposites.
So what should the U.S. do to discourage this temptation of taking Tripoli by force and at the same time support the UN strategy for Libya?
Well, I mean, the official position of the U.S. Has been to support the U.N. and to condemn any attempt to change the balance of power by force. So it already has the same approach officially. But I think the problem now is more that the U.S. is relatively disengaged from the Libyan issue under the current administration. Apart from fighting ISIS, there isn't really much of a U.S.-Libya policy at the moment, just nominal support for the U.N. process. And I think it's important to send General Haftar the message that he cannot just try and change the reality on the ground as part of the negotiations. If he's serious about negotiations, then he has to allow the delegations that represent the government he's loyal to do their job. That message isn't always clear, whether it's by the U.S. or by others, and not just for General Haftar's side, but also for the other side. And I think it's important for a major power like the U.S. to persuade Libyans directly, but also those who support the various camps and on General Haftar's side, I'm thinking especially of Egypt and the United Arab Emirates, to play more of a role to put pressure on General Haftar to stop resorting to incendiary rhetoric and threats to take the capital.
That was Isander El Amrani, North Africa Project Director at the International Crisis Group. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawy. Egypt's state news agency MENA says security forces have killed 12 armed militants in the country's western desert. No police were killed in the incident today. MENA reported that an anonymous security source said security forces dealt a severe blow to the terrorist elements in revenge for the blood of the men who were martyred last week. The shootout happened about 175 kilometers southwest of Cairo, near the location of last week's deadly attack on police. Authorities say at least 30 Egyptian policemen were killed last week in a western desert shootout with militants about 135 kilometers southwest of Cairo. In Zimbabwe, a return to growing small grains is one idea being considered to fight climate change and boost food production. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi takes a look at the idea and at other sustainable farming measures.
Majority of farmers deny climate change and have continued to plant crops like maize that need plenty of water to survive drought. But agricultural engineer Herbert Madzamba says recent weather events are changing their thinking.
Prolonged heat waves like we're experiencing in Harare now. The seasons have shifted. We no longer receive our rains late October. Now they come probably mid-November in some areas, which never used to be the case. We also have the flash flooding. These are all realities which happen year in, year out. Some people contest because they do not appreciate what agriculture is all about.
Madzamba works with seed companies and village women to implement better farming practices that includes biofortified seeds. He says Many farmers are looking for harder and more robust foods, many which were used decades ago before maize became popular. Among them are cereal crops such as sorghum, millet and rapoko, a small grain sometimes called finger millet.
Because they require less water, they require less nutrition, so you can grow them in any of the drier regions. They would survive with about 400 millimeters of rain. By so doing, they become an alternative.
Nelson Mudzingwa is a farmer and the national coordinator for the Zimbabwe Smallholder Organic Farmers Forum, which includes over 18,000 farmers. He explains his group's support for reviving these traditional foods.
That is one of the areas that we have been emphasizing quite a lot. We have four regional clusters, the central and the western. These are the most dry areas. In these areas, the small grains, they are only way of food production, and the small grains in particular, the cereals, the sorghum, the pale millet and the rapoko.
The Zimbabwe Smallholder Organic Farmers Forum encourages its members to adopt the farming practices dating back Zimbabwe's pre-colonial era before maize was introduced. Madzamba says that includes the use of new once used crops.
They don't yield more than maize. They yield less, but they can survive with less inputs and less rainfall. The small grains are more nutritious because even before maize came, those were consumed by our forefathers. The reason why we are now biofortifying maize is out of the realization that maize delivers less nutrition than the small grains, but we cannot harvest as much of small grains compared to maize.
The grains could be used to make the popular thick porridge called sadza, which is usually made from maize powder. But lack of research on the crops has resulted in the failure to develop machinery to plant, harvest, and process them at a large scale. The nutrition-rich crops have also gained a stigma because they are recommended for those with HIV and other illnesses, thus making marketing harder. Observers say a public enlightenment campaign may be needed to convince consumers and farmers to give the forgotten foods a try. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Many African countries are facing pressure to feed growing populations. At the same time, they are experiencing extreme weather conditions like drought and unusually heavy rains and flooding. One U.S. agency working with African partners to cope with the challenge is USAID, which is helping to implement the U.S. government's Feed the Future initiative. It works in a dozen countries around the world, including Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, Senegal, and Uganda. The administrator of USAID, Ambassador Mark Green, recently traveled to East Africa to assess the progress of his agency's efforts. He talked to reporter Peter Clotty about USAID's work to meet farmers' short and long-term needs in Ethiopia.
We have a program called Feed the Future, which I think is a great innovation. I'm a big supporter, big believer in it. And that helps us on the resilience side. So on one hand, there's the immediate need, and we will be there working with host country partners to provide food and water if we can to meet with immediate needs. But again, what we want to do is to apply these technologies and these tools to help people help themselves going forward. So it's a combination of those immediate needs, basic nutrition, because we all know that in a child's life, those first months are so crucial to that child's future intellectual development. We'll always be there for that, but then also working with them to take on those longer-term challenges. Nobody can predict exactly when disaster will strike, but we can take steps to protect ourselves and strengthen ourselves against the impact and the effects.
So far, how have these people reacted to some of these programs and measures that you've talked to them about?
They've embraced them. I'll give you an example of Ethiopia, where I was at a food distribution, and I remember we had just provided some grain to a woman who was going to take it and divide it up for her family, and she asked me if she could ask a question. I said, sure. And her question was the perfect question. And the question was, can you help me with irrigation so I never have to do this again? I thought, that's the question. There's a woman who's trying desperately to provide for her own family. looking for help, not looking for handouts. She doesn't want to take grain. She'll take grain because her family's hungry, but what she wants to do is lead herself and her family and her community, and so embrace it. I saw a microfinance facility in the Somali region in Ethiopia in which we were helping particularly women who have a difficult time getting credit to help them do their small businesses. I saw it doing so well that a traditional bank across the road, as I was at the microfinance facility, they were all staring down. They were not happy because everybody was doing the microfinance, a lot of it SMS-based, cell phone-based. I also saw a program that was helping farmers provide fodder for cattle, sort of counter-cycle so that they're protected when the drought occurs. And then finally, I went to a wonderful facility. It was a slaughterhouse. In the slaughterhouse, they were bringing in high-quality carcasses to be able to dress down and then provide to Middle East, selling to the Middle East. So taking that wonderful resource they have in Ethiopia, wonderful pastoral lifestyles, and they produce very high-quality meat, serving a market that provides them with real capital and hard capital that they can use for the future. So what we've seen is that people embrace these tools. Again, you know, the Africans that I know are like everyone else. They want to lead themselves. They don't want a hand out. They're looking for a hand up. We can help them with these tools.
That was the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Ambassador Mark Green. He says U.S. efforts to boost world food production has included nearly $3 billion in agricultural loans and more than $800 million in private sector investments for farmers over the past 6 years. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Cloti. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And of course, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Cloti, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Greetings and happy Friday to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to the sunny side of sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Our starting line on the sunny side of sports is African athletics. Some of Kenya's best long-distance runners will be chasing more international marathon titles this weekend, including a race in Frankfurt, Germany. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with one of Kenya's Olympic champions who will test her endurance on Sunday in Frankfurt. Here's Andy.
The Minova Frankfurt Marathon has a first this year. Even before anyone's set off from the start line on Sunday, they've got, for the first time ever, an Olympic champion from the track running, and that's Vivian Cheruiyot of Kenya, who's won the 5,000-meter title in Rio in 2016. Five world titles on the track as well. Vivian, this will be your second marathon. You ran 2:23, fourth place in London in April. How is the adaptation going from being a track runner, because now you, I think you say you're concentrating purely on the road, to being a marathon runner? Is that an easy switch, or do you feel you're learning a lot?
I want to say that switching from track to marathon, there is some difficulties between track and marathon. The track, it's normally, when you train, it's easier, but it's a little bit high speed. But for marathon, the difficult place is long, when you are doing long runs, and it's a long event. But I know maybe when I've been racing 2 to 3 marathons, I'll get used.
So is it a case both physically and mentally? Because you say getting used to doing long runs. I mean, of course, people would assume you do quite long runs, 5 and 10,000-meter runner. But is it sure the length of time that you are out on your feet, but also the length of the race, the marathon?
Yes, it is, because it's our longest event, and for me, because I was coming from the track, I feel like it's too long for me. But now I'm catching up. I'm catching up slowly, because in my mind I'm ready that now I'm focusing on marathon. So I'm going to catch a phase soon, because I've decided to go for marathon and I should do the marathon. So I should focus on that side.
Remembering interviews with Haile Gebrselassie and Paul Tergat, for example, they talked of how they had great track success, of course, but they had to adapt. And sometimes it was a case of actually how your foot comes down. You're used to running in running spikes, and now your race is on the road and you're running in racing flats. Do you have to make adaptations, changes there?
Yes, I have to make it, because I used to train with spikes at the track, and now it has been almost 1 year without using spikes. So I'm getting used to it, because when you are using the racing shoes, you feel that you are not moving. But I have to get used to it, because that is the way forward in marathon.
Well, you certainly were moving, because you ran 2:23 in London. I mean, we're now in Frankfurt, a couple of days from the race. In the elite women's field, five runners have run faster than you, although your 2:23 is clearly a pretty quick time. Do you see yourself as a favourite?
I want to say that I just came here to run my own race. I'm not running against anybody. But for what I was coming here is to lower my personal best. And I know the ladies from Ethiopia, they're also strong, because there is one of 2:20. And I don't want to say I'm running against somebody or what. I'm going to run my own race, and I'm going to push, and I'm going to try to run my personal best. So I don't care about who is in the race. I'm coming here to run my own race.
Yeah, because that course record for the women, 2:21.01, Meselek Melkamu of Ethiopia, five years ago now. That do you feel that might be too big a jump to be taking, well, more than 2 minutes off? You're just going to see what happens?
Yes, it's going to be possible, because when I was in London, it was my first marathon. I did a mistake the first year of marathon, the first year, and the second one was so slow. But so this time I know I learned by mistake, and I should not repeat the same thing. So I hope if I balance very well, I'll make a course record.
Vivian Cheruiyot, we'll be interested to see how you apply those lessons learnt from London to the Minova Frankfurt Marathon on Sunday. All the best for the race. Thank you, Vivian.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
The energetic Andy Edwards also caught up with Kenya's defending men's champion in Frankfurt. Once again, here's Andy.
It's the Minova Frankfurt Marathon. It's a couple of days before the race, and I'm sitting with the defending men's champion, Mark Kuria of Kenya. Won a thrilling contest against two other very good Kenyans in 2016. A great finish in the Festhalle in Frankfurt. So, Mark, how's the last year gone for you? It was a really impressive performance for you to win. Are you feeling equally good for the 2017 race?
Okay, thank you very much. I think last year was my second achievement.
in Frankfurt Marathon. So this time round, I think I've trained enough. My training has been going on well, and I've prepared. I've trained hard, and I hope this time round I'll do much better than last year.
I think it was a classic marathon in that the decisive moments came with about 35, 36 kilometres. There was you, Cyprian Kortut, and Mark Koskaj, who finished second, who's sitting on the sofa next to us as well. Do you anticipate it to be similar? Because really, it all seemed to come down to the last 7 or 8 kilometres.
I think last year was pacemakers didn't do well in pacemaking. So I think this time around, Hayata is a good guys who can pace until 30 kilometers. Last year was a little slow, but I tried in 35 kilometers to push, and I really ran 2:06.
What's your training been like? Are there indications that you're in equally good form from your training, your build-up for this race?
Okay, since last year, since running in Frankfurt, I went there and trained hard. And then in March, I did my second marathon in Seoul Marathon. And I did better. I ran 2:06.05 seconds. And I really see that I'm coming. I'm achieving much better.
Yeah, that race in Seoul, South Korea, you were ninth in that marathon, and you seemed like you've spaced them apart very nicely, the spring marathon, and now we're in another of the classic autumn marathon racing seasons. And just lastly, you were the first man across the line in the Festhalle, the concert hall in Frankfurt last year. It's a finish line that everybody remembers. I mean, is that the same for you? I mean, you're the elite. You're thinking of prize money and running fast, but is that still a special finish line for you in the Festhalle in Frankfurt?
Okay, I think I want to repeat like last year, and I really enjoy finishing, crossing the red carpet. It was really fantastic for me.
Well, we wish you, Mark Correa, the defending champion of the Minova Frankfurt Marathon, and everybody else in the elite and mass field, a great race on Sunday. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America. Oh, keep on the sunny side. Always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help you every day. It will brighten all the way. If you keep on the sunny side of life. Oh, keep on the sunny side. Always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help you every day. It will brighten.
Our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta, is back on the sunny side of sports on this Friday. Namdi says keep your eyes on a Nigerian heavyweight who recently launched his prize-fighting career.
Oh, Sonny, we're smiling right here because we have a heavyweight from Nigeria. Efe Ajagba. Saturday night, he scored the second knockout in 2 fights. First round, he had his opponent out with 2 knockdowns. Remember now, he's a 2016 Rio Olympian. And now he has a good team in Ronnie Shield, his trainer that trained Evander Holyfield, and a promoter and Richard Schaefer that built Golden Boy with Oscar De La Hoya, Ring Star Promotions. With these two combinations, Efe Ajagba has a good team now. A heavyweight that can deliver the knockout is what we're looking for in that division today. So we look for 2018 to be a big year for Nigerian heavyweight Efe Ajagba.
Will he be based here in the States, Namdi?
He is based in Florida, and things are going very well. All they need to do is to really take good care of him, put the right people in front of him, have him knocking out guys on TV live, and then he'll be, by this time, 2018, we may be looking at homeboy striking.
All right. Let's stay with the heavyweights, Namdi, and we're going to go to Cardiff, Wales. That's where world heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua will put three of his title belts on the line Saturday night when he fights Carlos Takam. Takam, late replacement for Joshua's original opponent, the Bulgarian Kubrat Pulev, who pulled out with a shoulder injury. Namdi, the reports I'm reading say they could get a crowd of up to 80,000 at the Principality Stadium in Cardiff.
Sonny, the Principality Stadium has already got 80,000 tickets sold. Don't tell me AJ Homeboy is not a draw. Deontay Wilder can barely sell 10,000 at Barclays Arena next month.
From an African perspective, Namdi, is it true this is the first time two fighters with African roots will vie for the world heavyweight title?
Sonny, you're right. Carlos Takam, born and raised in Douala, Cameroon. This is the first time we have two Africans go toe-to-toe, and we expect a good fight. And the question becomes, who is Carlos Takam? Well, he's had 39 fights with 27 knockouts. He's not a bad fighter. Is he Kubrat Pulev? Even people believe that he's better than Kubrat Pulev.
Well, let's hear what AJ has to say about Takam, Namdi. And here's how AJ sizes up Carlos Takam.
So I've been fighting guys that are a lot taller than me. I've been preparing for a 6-foot-something guy, and now I'm fighting this mini Mike Tyson, Ray Mercer, Tommy Morrison, boom, hooking. So I'm going to have to kind of revert back to some different training techniques and get ready to dig deeper, stand in the trenches and trade with him and slow him down a bit. Because if not, I'm going to be jabbing and getting caught with silly left hooks and overhand rights because he's a lot shorter. That's going to be his game, is to take me out of my rhythm, and I'm going to have to learn how to deal with that.
Namdi, we heard AJ compare Takam to a mini Mike Tyson or even a Ray Mercer. Your thoughts?
Well, Takam is a 6'1". So if Takam can go past AJ's jab and stay in the pocket, which means stay in the body and do damage in the ribs, he stands a good chance of scoring a knockout. I believe what's going to happen, the question becomes, is AJ taking his eyes off the ball, thinking of Deontay Wilder, and then allowing Takam to come there and upset things? I think in front of 80,000 people, homeboy better TCB, which means take care of business, because the big part right there is Deontay Wilder at the Wembley Arena in 2018.
Namdi, this will be Anthony Joshua's first fight in 6 months. He stopped former world champion Vladimir Klitschko in the 11th round at Wembley Stadium in London at the end of April. That was an action-packed fight, Namdi. Do you think it took anything out of AJ?
No, really, he's had time to heal, and I believe if he's well-rested, he can perform and do his thing on Saturday night.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta. In Cardiff Friday, Anthony Joshua weighed in at 254 1/4 pounds, the heaviest he's ever been for a fight, while Carlos Takam tipped the scales at 235 1/2 pounds. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
So keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help you every day. It will brighten our way if you keep on the sunny side of life.
All right, Roy.
The song of hope each day. Though the moments be cloudy or fair, let us trust in our Savior always to keep us everyone in his care. So keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help you every day. It will brighten all the way if you keep on the sunny side of life. Mm-hmm.
Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is Andrew Palcheski, the VOA's social media reporter. Happy Friday, Andrew.
Happy Friday to you as well, Sonny. Good to be here as always.
Welcome back, Andrew. What's trending on this Friday?
Well, we start with a story with a sport that we don't really talk about much, which is golf. And we really don't talk about high school golf very much at all. But this story is trending today because of a high school golfer named Emily Nash. She is 16 years old. She lives in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. And the school that she attends does not have a girls' golf team, so she plays with the boys. And this week, she won first place in a boys' golf tournament, beating the other male competitors using the same exact tees, using the same exact equipment that they were using. Now, as an added bonus, in addition to winning that tournament, the winner qualified for the state championships. But officials there say that Nash won't get first place, won't get the prize money, and won't go to the state championships simply because she is a girl. They say that girls cannot play in the boys' golf league. They can play as part of a team in the boys' golf league, but can't play as individuals. So this has kicked off a social media debate. Is this sexism because she's not being treated fairly? Could she have just played in the girls' tournament instead of the boys' tournament? Even if she's just an individual golfer and her school doesn't have a golf program, couldn't she have just done it on her own? Others asking, why can't women play against men if they're all following the same rules? There are some sports like tennis where the battle of the sexes has been debated because people say, well, it's a physical sport that men and women are equipped differently and they play differently. But she was playing off of the men's tees in the same spot they were playing, same kind of clubs, everything. So people wondering, why can't they all just play together? And other people wondering, well, if you do that, then why can't men play in women's events? So these are issues that have been going on for years and years, as we've talked about on the show before, the battle of the sexes between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs in tennis,
right.
Something that was 43, 44 years ago, and it's still being talked about today. But amid that debate, Nash is getting some support from across the internet, including from American golfer Lexi Thompson, who's the number three female golfer in the world and the youngest woman ever to win an LPGA tournament at the age of 16 when she won that. She wrote on Twitter, congrats to Emily Nash on her big win. Keep following your dreams and nothing can stop you. Hashtag girl power. So she's getting some great support from the golf world. And another person getting support, Sonny, the boy who finished in second place behind Emily Nash, he reportedly offered to give her the first place trophy, saying that she earned it and she deserved it.
Oh, so nice he's gesture.
A very nice gesture. But these are issues that are kind of rearing up again in social media. Issues that have been talked about for quite a while, and I think they're issues that are going to still be talked about for years to come.
What else is trending out there, Andrew?
Well, another issue that's being talked about for quite a while are the protests in the National Football League. And as we talked about on the show, players and team owners were going to meet in New York at NFL headquarters to kind of sort this out. That was part of that press release that NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell released. Well, that meeting happened about 2 weeks ago, but we're getting word now in an article online about what happened in that meeting. And there's one instance in particular that is getting a lot of social media attention. It comes from Bob McNair, who is the owner of the Houston Texans football team. He reportedly said when talking about the protests, "We can't have the inmates running the prison." Now, McNair is white. Many of the players on his team are black. And a lot of people on social media saying that this is a racist statement to call his players and the people on his team, refer to them as inmates running the prison. So many people calling for him to apologize as a result of this. Other people noting that it's similar to another common idiom in the English language, which is the inmates are running the asylum.
I've heard that one.
That one I've heard before as well. So people saying, well, maybe he got his words mixed up. Many people also noting that McNair is a big supporter and major donor to President Trump, who is kicked off the kind of debate about patriotism and race and all these things in the National Football League in recent months with these protests. So Bob McNair is a trending topic today. No word yet if he's going to apologize or if he's going to make any statement about this. But right now he's getting a lot of negative attention because of those words.
Any reaction, Andrew, from his players on the team?
Not yet, but a lot of people wondering what's going to happen this Sunday, if the players are going to kneel collectively or sit or have some kind of gesture to protest what he said, because it's not sitting well with a lot of fans.
So the national anthem protest still very much a hot topic this season.
Absolutely.
What else is trending out there, Andrew?
Well, Sonny, it's not just social media that's talking about these stories. Sometimes social media is the reason for these stories, and that is what happened with the case of Martavis Bryant of the Pittsburgh Steelers. After last Sunday's win against the Cincinnati Bengals, Bryant took to Instagram to complain that he did not get the ball enough during the game. He only had two passes that were thrown his way. Now, when one fan commented on Instagram that Bryant's teammate, Juju Smith-Schuster, was a better player, Bryant responded, he said, "Juju is nowhere near better than me. All they need to do is give me what I want, and y'all can have Juju and whoever else." And he continued on in another comment. He said, "Juju is the future. He has great talent. He's going to be one of the best to play the game. I want to get him to get his. I just want mine, period, point blank." Well, after that message on Instagram, the Steelers have a message for Martavis Bryant. If you're not happy that you're not getting the ball enough, then you're not getting the ball at all, because the team says he's been benched for this Sunday's game against the Detroit Lions. Some fans going as far as saying he should be traded because of these comments. If he doesn't like how he gets to play, then he shouldn't have an opportunity to play at all, let alone just 1 week of suspension. But other fans questioning this. Again, with the NFL protest, there's been a lot of talk about players speaking out what they can and can't say. And that's the line of thought here. Some fans are wondering, why can't he speak out? If this is his opinion about his teammate, it may not be good form as a teammate, as part of the same team, but he should be allowed to speak out openly on his social media channels.
The Steelers do have a black coach. I think that's worth pointing out, Andrew.
They do.
I wonder
they
if Mike do. Tomlin had any input in this benching.
I'm not sure. It's unclear who made that decision, but maybe he'll be a little more careful with what he says on social media.
Again, maybe the perils of using social media.
Sometimes it can be perilous, that is for sure. But one instance where it was not perilous, although it did involve a suspension, is Oakland Raiders running back Marshawn Lynch. He got into a scuffle with a referee and was suspended one game because he accidentally kind of pushed the referee out of the way during a fight. But just because he can't play this week and can't practice this week doesn't mean he's not going to play elsewhere. So where did Marshawn Lynch go this week to keep his skills sharp? Back to his high school. So he took the field at Oakland Technical High School, sporting his Raiders helmet. And as we saw on his Instagram account, he put up a video of him playing with the students there. Kind of a cool moment for them. One thing I thought that was pretty funny, it takes about, in one of the plays, five or six high schoolers to take down Lynch as he's running with the ball. So it gives you some perspective of how good he is and the skills gap between high school and the National Football League. But Michael Bennett, who used to play with Lynch on the Seattle Seahawks, said he saw the video and he couldn't stop laughing. He thought it was great. And a lot of fans think it's great, too.
Andrew Palcheski, the VOA social media reporter. Have a good weekend, Andrew.
Thanks so much, Sonny. You too.
And that wraps up the October 27th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Peter Hundley. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington. Have a nice weekend, everyone. And that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, The group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
This is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscast. Every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Joe Palca reporting. Catalonia declares its independence. Catalonia's regional parliament declared independence from Spain on Friday in a disputed vote that is now likely to be declared illegal by Spain's constitutional court. Separatist lawmakers erupted in applause as the vote was approved. Most opposition lawmakers had left the chamber in protest moments before the vote. No country has expressed support for the secession bid. In response, the Spanish Senate in Madrid voted today to give wide-ranging powers to the central government to rescind Catalonian autonomy and take over control of the region. Mariano Rajoy, the Spanish Prime Prime Minister told reporters what happened today in the Catalonia Parliament is irrefutable proof of how necessary it was for the Senate to approve the proposal the government made. Today, the Catalonia Parliament has approved something that not only goes against the law, but is a criminal act. The Catalan motion calls for beginning an independence process that includes drafting Catalonia's new laws and opening negotiations on equal footing with Spanish authorities. The U.S.-led coalition fighting Islamic State announced Friday morning a ceasefire between Iraqi forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga in northern Iraq, but quickly backtracked on the claim, saying it was not an official ceasefire. The Iraqi military and the Kurdish minority have been clashing for several weeks after the Iraqi troops moved in to secure areas in northern Iraq that had been seized from IS jihadists. The United Nations said Friday the Myanmar government has agreed to allow it to resume its food distribution operations in northern Rakhine State after a two-month suspension. The agreement was announced as the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund reporting that Rohingya children were close to death from malnutrition. This is VOA News. Kenya's Electoral Commission has called for patience and calm as it tallies the results of Thursday's rerun presidential election. However, some fear already that there the low turnout. With more, VOA's Jill Craig from Nairobi.
The chief of Kenya's Electoral Commission says 6.5 million voters, about one-third of all registered voters, cast ballots in the election Thursday. Opposition leader Raila Odinga told his supporters to boycott the vote, and some polling stations looked like ghost towns. Murithi Mutiga is the International Crisis Group's Kenya analyst.
If this turns out to be the final act in what has been a very dramatic election, it will be a very unsatisfactory conclusion for all sides. Certainly for the president, he will move forward with what seems like a very shaky mandate without a clear mandate from the people.
The opposition has not said whether it plans to file a legal challenge against the results of Thursday's election. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Officials say the voting is expected to resume on Saturday in some locations because several polling stations were unable to open due to security concerns. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, along with four senators, have been disqualified from Parliament because they held dual citizenship at the time of the last election. Malcolm Turnbull is the Australian Prime Minister.
The decision of the court today is clearly not the outcome we were hoping for, but the business of government goes on.
Australia's constitution bans subjects of foreign powers from sitting in federal parliament. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has no role to play in the future of his country, and he must go. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
He says the United States wants to see Syria emerge from this war as a whole and unified country, a country in which President Bashar al-Assad has no role to play.
I've said this many times as well, that we do not believe there is a future for the Assad regime, the Assad family. I think I've said it on a number of occasions, the reign of the Assad family is coming to an end, and the only issue is how should that be brought about? And we believe it can be brought about and will be brought about.
Tillerson says he supports the so-called Geneva process